Thank you, Ted, very much, and thank you so much for the invitation to come and be with you again. I'm going to add a little bit to the introduction of my friend and colleague, the Reverend Dr. Chris Chikoyan, who I would say, first of all, is my pastor. We actually, she was the pastor to me and to my family for many years. I was able to serve as her parish associate for, I think, 6 years. Then she was a member of the board at McCormick Seminary, where I was dean and vice president and a member of the faculty and so on. And so when she heard the nudging of the Spirit and the pestering of some of us to come and take this position, I was very pleased. So thank you, Chris, so much for being with us. Let's begin with prayer. Let us pray. Gracious God, we give you thanks for this day and the life and light that it brings. Thank you for this congregation and the commitments that are so clear here to be with you in your work in the world. Give us faith and courage to follow where you lead, even in this hour. We give you thanks. Amen. So I'm going to say a few words about what's happened at the seminary with regard to our being attentive to the needs of refugees, or trying to be. Say a few things about the theological or the scriptural foundation for that work, and then I'm going to turn to Chris, who will lead us in some wider conversations about refugees and Presbyterian response to refugees. So a couple of years ago, it was the fall of 2015, and the refugee situation, the refugee crisis in Europe was really getting worse. You may recall that Pope Francis issued a call to Catholic parishes saying that each parish or each congregation should be able to house one family. Should be possible for one congregation to do that. So one of our colleagues at the seminary, a staff colleague, came to me, happens that she is also Roman Catholic, she came to me and said, look, if a congregation, a parish, could be responsible for housing one family, surely we as a seminary should be able to make the same kind of commitment. I thought, She pointed out that we have excess housing. You may know that the seminary has quite extensive housing, which we normally fill up with some of our own students and then rent out to students from other schools, from Pitt and CMU and Duquesne primarily. But we always have a few in between because we have a number of units. And I thought, Now, I'd only been at the seminary a couple of months. I didn't know any better. And so I started talking to folks. So what do you think? Isn't this a great idea? And now, this is part of the story you probably shouldn't repeat, but many of the people I talked to at first said, no, that's a bad idea. And I was discouraged by that and disappointed. And there were two main reasons. There were three. Of course, the third one is the usual one. You know, we haven't done that before, so we probably shouldn't do that. But the two other ones, the first one was, well, that's not our business. We're in the business of preparation for ministry, and that's a different kind of business, so we shouldn't do that. But that, for me, was a very significant kind of call to think about. So why do we do this that we do as a congregation or as a seminary, as a person of faith trying to follow Jesus? Why do we do what we do? Yes, we have a particular mission, but, and then my mind went to those parts of Paul's letters where he's taking up a collection for the folks in Jerusalem. There's a famine. And so the people, the believers in Jerusalem, didn't have enough to eat. And you may remember these lines Paul is writing. So we need to take a collection, but recognize here it's so that those who have, no one will have too much and no one will have too little. And I'm thinking, we have more housing than we need here. We have too much housing. And there are folks who need housing. Shouldn't we be able to figure out some way to do this? Certainly in order to, at least by the way we run our affairs, be a model of trying to be a faithful steward of what we have. So that was one reason. The other reason, in some ways, was weird and just wacky. And the response was, what's scary? We'd be frightened. These are dangerous people. Now, just a moment's thought, and I realized that certainly anyone that would come through the agencies, we had thought about working with various agencies that Chris will talk more about, have been through often years of vetting. And I realized I had come as president, and I didn't have that kind of vetting. I had to do a couple of tests, and people talked to me. But there was no, I was more dangerous on paper than the folks who would come to us. I'm serious about this. So why are we frightened? I remember bumping into a couple of colleagues who were talking to each other, not to me, and I overheard them, and they were saying, this is a really bad idea. It would be a frightening thing if we had refugees living in our housing. And I said, come on, let's talk about this a bit. And when we went through this conversation, they said, well, you know, David, we're just being devil's advocates. And I thought, wait a minute, the devil has enough advocates. Right? We should be advocates for Jesus. We shouldn't be advocates for why we can't do something for the devil. This whole idea of being a devil's advocate. Anyway, so we need to be advocates for Jesus. And there's no question here about danger. So it seemed clear. And do you mind if I introduce you? It happens that the CFO at the seminary at the time is sitting right here, Ann Getkin. And she's the one who made this happen. And the fact you came this and this morning is so gracious of you to be here in this session. So we had folks, some staff, saying we need to think about how we could provide housing, and our the person responsible for housing and finance actually made it happen, and that's Ann, who's sitting here this morning. So I began to think then about the framework, the theological, why would we do this? Why would, you know, we're supposed to grant degrees and offer continuing education. Why would we it didn't seem very hard, but why would we do this? And I began to think through the whole framework, the bedrock in Scripture. The foundation is about hospitality. It's about recognizing all that we have comes from God, and so we should now make that generosity available and obvious to others. And I started thinking about this, I realized that it's the whole of Scripture. It begins at the beginning in creation. We receive the gifts of God's creation by simply being alive in God's creation. So we are sustained by God's abundant provision. In creation, we are guests. Of course, at the Lord's table, we are guests. Maybe the most profound theologically. And then there's other themes to the Old Testament. Lived for some years in Illinois. Jane, my spouse, was a pastor downstate Illinois among farm people. And I got into trouble many times when I talked about Leviticus 25, where you know this passage, which for me is so very profound and very important, that the land belongs to God. It doesn't belong to us. You are aliens and tenants, the passage says. Don't think you can own the land forever. But the land belongs to me, says the Lord. Don't think you can buy it and sell it as though you can keep it. It belongs to me. So all that we have because of God's hospitality, God's generosity to us. So, receiving these gifts, we need to be attentive about how we can illustrate by the way we live what we've received and so offer it to others. And in doing so, we offer it to God because we see God, we see our Lord in the face of the other. We see this most clearly in the parable in Matthew 25. When did we see you hungry and give you food? When was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you? When was it we saw you a stranger and didn't welcome you? And Jesus says, it's when you didn't welcome the least of these, you did not welcome me. So when did we see you? Of course, when I ask myself that question, which I don't often enough, the answer is every day. Every day. When did we see you, a stranger? Maybe the best illustration, and I think a story we all know very, very well, but it is the illustration for me that brings this home most directly. It's when, on the road to Emmaus, there is a stranger, unidentified, but the two disciples who were so despondent, the fact that they welcomed Jesus, even in their lack of hope, they had lost hope by that time. They said, we had hoped that this one would be the one we were looking for. They had lost hope. And yet they welcomed Jesus in. And then, of course, Jesus takes the bread, breaks it, gives it to them. And they receive the gift, the blessed gift of sight and of communion, as they realize that they are welcoming the risen Lord. So as we welcome the stranger, we are welcoming the risen Lord. So it seems clear, right? We have extra apartments. We should be able to provide space for refugees. And good folks at the seminary started this. This would have been in, I said, the fall of 2015. In November, if my memory and notes are correct, we welcomed a family from Afghanistan, stayed with us a week or two, then went on to permanent housing. And over the time since then, we have made housing available as we've gone along. So that's the background and framework. questions?
Thank you for having us. This is wonderful to be here. So, I've been at the seminary all of 10 weeks. So, this is the first I've heard some of the details of this story. Thank you for making this happen. And this is the way the people of God should be. I wanted to offer a little bit of data of where we are today with the refugee situation around the world. A little bit of historic framework, and then I want to share my own family's story. And last but not least, we'll get to the handout and how you particularly can help and roll up your sleeves. So, data. Some of us are really big on data, others less so, but for those of you who are data freaks, United Nations Refugee Agency cites these statistics. Around the world, there are 65.6 million people who are displaced. 65.6 million people who are displaced. Now, they're displaced for a number of reasons. Some of them are displaced by war, by food shortages, by disease, by internal conflicts within a nation, by ethnic issues, by economic issues. They're displaced because they cannot make a living for themselves. Of that 65.6 million, 22.5 million are technically refugees. So we have 22.5 million refugees on our planet. Any guesses on how many of them are children? Half. Half of them are under 18 years old. Globally, nearly one in 200 children is a refugee. Can you even imagine? That figure has doubled over the last 10 years, in just 10 years' time. And so we think about the patterns that we've had in the past and where we are today. It gives perspective on how critical the need is and how overwhelming it can feel. Well, where are these people from? From where are they displaced? There are three primary areas that are at play. South Sudan has exited 1.4 million refugees, South Sudan. Afghanistan, 2.5 million refugees, and that's been going on for a long time. I don't know if you remember, David, but our church in the western suburbs hosted an Afghani family as refugees as the war started. So, and right now, the most crucial place, the most impacted place is Syria, with 5.5 million refugees. 5.5 million refugees coming from Syria alone. So what countries are hosting these refugees? I looked up statistics from the UN, from Reuters News, and also from the World Economic Forum. So you might find on different sites different numbers, but this is kind of an amalgamation of them. I figure the more reputable sites one can look at, the likelier the data is true. So, I imagined that Western countries would have been the primary hosting sites, but I was wrong. So, of all of the countries that are hosting, and I'll go through this really quickly, Turkey is hosting 2.5 million, Jordan, 2.5 million, Pakistan, 1.5 million, Lebanon, 1.5 million, I was on the board of the Lebanese American University for 9 years, and Lebanon has been hosting refugees to the point where about half the population is now displaced people. Iran, 1 million people it's hosting. Uganda is hosting 1 million people, and Ethiopia is hosting almost 1 million people. Now, many of those nations are not necessarily well-equipped. Nevertheless, they welcome anyway. Developing nations host 86% of refugees. Developing nations host 86% of refugees. Europe has about 300,000 refugees, and if you've been following the news, you know that there are ups and downs about that. Some of them are unwanted for a long time. There still are. Boats crossing the Mediterranean and landing on the islands, and then what do you do with them? Germany has been up and down in its reception of refugees. Angela Merkel is getting a lot of pushback on that, but there's a question of what to do. And other nations have really flipped the other direction. And then there's America. In 2017, we had a cap of 110,000 refugees. In 2017, a cap of 110,000. For 2018, they're looking at a cap of 45,000 refugees to serve the 22.5 million refugees around the planet. Offices are closing right and left, and of course, we're also dealing with the Muslim ban. So that's where we are as a country right now. Now, I want to give a little bit of historic perspective because for me that's helpful. To be fair, we've been here before in America. In 1938, Fortune magazine published the results of a poll it conducted. Fewer than 5% of Americans surveyed wanted to welcome refugees from fascist states in Europe in 1938. Fewer than 5% of Americans wanted to welcome them. The majority of those refugees, of course, were Jewish. Two-thirds of the respondents to that 1938 poll said that we should work hard to keep those refugees out. Now, granted, we were just emerging from the Great Depression. We were scared. There was the beginning of the America First movement, which, as a side note, was sponsored in part by one of my former parishioners in Lake Forest when he was at Yale University. He changed his mind. So, it was before Kristallnacht. One could expect some American resistance. But even after Kristallnacht in November of 1938, even after Kristallnacht, two-thirds of Americans said they would not take in 10,000 German, usually Jewish, refugee children. 1938, after Kristallnacht, Americans, two-thirds, didn't want those people here. Some of you know the story of the MS St. Louis. It was a ship with 900 Jewish refugees who fled to the U.S. via Cuba. They were not allowed in. They were turned away from the port of Miami. Some of those refugees, when they went back, found solace in places around Europe. But 254 of those whom we turned away, we know, were killed in the Holocaust. And those are decisions Americans have made. In all, you know the story. 6 million Jews were killed, along with Roma and homosexuals and others who were deemed threatening. And I wonder what might have happened if America had responded differently. Now, I know that America was very generous during World War II. In fact, I am proud to say that both of my parents were in the Army. They met there. But what about the refugees? Why didn't we take them? And what difference might it have made if we did? Well, before I get to the what can we do today, I have to share a story about why this matters so much to me personally. You can tell by my last name that I am Armenian. Anytime you see a Y-A-N or an I-A-N at the end, you know it. I didn't take my husband's name when we married. His last name is Shostiski, and it would have been 18 letters to hyphenate. I do not blame my daughter for taking her husband's name, which is Son, which is only 4 letters. He is, by the way, Jewish. But I'm Armenian. And over a century ago, at the decline of the Ottoman Empire, the Young Turk movement rose. How many of you know about the Armenian story? Yeah, a number of you do, but many have never heard about it. It's not the biggest news. But the Young Turk movement rose at the fall as the Ottoman Empire is declining. Now, notice patterns when empires start declining, as in Germany, nationalism often rises. And that nationalism, in that case, in both of those cases, that nationalism pitted peoples against each other. So the Kurds were pitted against the Armenians. The Turks pitted the Kurds against the Armenians. And the Kurds were mostly Muslim, and the Armenians were Christian. So the Christian Armenians were seen as the other, as the outsider, as the threatening one, even though it had been centuries of living side by side together. So, Armenians were targeted, and in particular, elite Armenians were targeted, those who were educated, those who were in professions, which was true for my family. Why were they educated? Here's a lovely aside about Presbyterians. So Presbyterians and Congregationalists decided in the early 19th century to do global mission together, and they sent mission workers all over the world. Some of them landed in Turkey. For the most part, the Turkish Muslims weren't so interested in welcoming them, but some of the Armenian Christians were. My great-grandparents were among those. And they became Protestant instead of Orthodox. And they built the schools, and they built the hospitals, and they educated girls, imagine. And an aside, when my Armenian grandmother was married off to my Armenian grandfather, she was Protestant, and she put her 16-year-old foot down and said, "Even though my husband-to-be is Orthodox, I am not marrying him unless we raise the children Protestant, which is why I'm here." And I should warn you about my inheritance of that attitude. So, back to turn-of-the-century Turkey. My great-grandparents were among those educated, and they were very, very well-to-do merchants. And in 1895, the first uprising against the Armenians happened, and my great-grandfather was one of those targeted. His store was ravaged, and he was left for dead. And his family wondered whether to flee, and they didn't. They stayed. Now, one of his daughters, my grandmother, was one of those who came over for financial reasons, and America welcomed them. But most of the family stayed. There were more incidents over the years as the new government fanned the flames of anti-Armenian sentiment. By 1915, we endured our equivalent of Kristallnacht over 1.5 Armenians were killed. Now there were maybe 200,000 left in Turkey, including my great-grandfather and great-uncles shot or beheaded, the women abused and then forced on death marches, which is how my great-grandmother and great-aunts and their children died. And I stand here today because America had welcomed my grandparents. And if America had not welcomed my grandparents, I and my family would not exist. And that's why it matters personally to me. I can never repay that debt of gratitude to this nation. And I can never forget when I see the face of my own family in the faces of refugees now. It's personal. So what can we do? Well, I love the phrase, think globally, act locally. So I want you to look at your handout, not the one about Pittsburgh Seminary, though I do hope that you will look at that, but the Presbyterians Respond to Refugees handout, because I have a number of pieces here that I hope will be helpful to you as you consider what you personally and what you as a congregation might do to consider welcoming refugees. The first thing I want to do is talk about some of the local resources that we have in the Pittsburgh area. Many of my colleagues at the seminary have worked with these agencies very closely, and I don't know, Anne may be able to tell more about those as well. But each of these three is one that has official sponsorship of refugees and is not working behind the scenes, but is working very openly so that there is no illegal activity going on here. The first is Jewish Family and Children's Service, which I find really heartwarming that they are welcoming not just Jewish refugees by any stretch of the imagination. They are welcoming all refugees because of what they experienced in their own families during World War II. And there are a number of things. I encourage you to look at their websites and to be in touch with these people that I've named here. So Jewish Family and Children's Services. There are things that you can do as individuals. You can volunteer with families. One of the neat things that they do is pair people, volunteers, with particular families who are coming over. And these families need a variety of things. They need Sherpas, if you will. They need people who will accompany them to get to know the Pittsburgh area. They need people who are able to, you know, navigate. Besides the staff people do the heavy lifting, of course, because they know the territory. They do all the legal work. But they need people to make these refugees feel welcome and at home. Where are the grocery stores? How do you use buses? You know, where can you find a worshiping community of your faith? Even helping with English. It's not a technical English as a second language. You know, you need training for that. Some of you may do that already. But even practicing English with them. When there are children, reading books to the children. It's a lovely thing to do. They even have this lovely program called Refugee Family Fun. Of course families should be having fun. So Refugee Family Fun includes groups of refugees going to hospitality, to a university open house where the students are doing a reception for them, or going to the museum with the kids, introducing them to Christmas in Pittsburgh. Whatever it is, these monthly events, and you don't have to be in for the long haul to volunteer for that. You just call them up and say, I'd like to be a helper for that, and you can do it once. And it's a great way to get acquainted with the kinds of things they're doing. The second organization I have on the sheet is Community Assistance and Refugee Resettlement, which is a part of the Northern Area Multi-Service Center. CAR, as it's called, does a number of things as well. There are higher level and lower level volunteering in terms of the intensity of it. So there are some things that you can do kind of from afar. If you know of landlords that might be open to having a refugee family, let them know, because they need places like the apartments on the campus. You know, these are short-term or longer-term places where refugees can live. If you know of any job availability, especially for somebody who does not have English as a first language, these people place these refugees in jobs, and they need as many referrals as they can possibly get. If you are looking for something a little deeper, you can work with refugees to prepare them for job interviews. You know, basic things, we think about that with kids graduating from college. They need to be prepared in how to interview. This is something that you can do to help. You can do tutoring in English, and you can, even if you're not one of those, they're different gifts and it's the same Spirit who gives them. If you're not one of those who wants one-on-one interaction with refugees, but you are great on a computer, or you can even put stamps on envelopes, they need office volunteers. So anything that you can do to help them, they'll find a place for you to volunteer. And last but not least, the Acculturation for Justice, Access, and Peace Outreach. They are primarily focused on African refugees, and they need all of those volunteer experiences. But in addition, if you have any particular affinity for any of the African countries, if you have been to Africa, if you know people, if you're simply not afraid of it, then this would be a place for you to volunteer. And these people, I mean, South Sudan is sending most of the refugees, but there are a whole lot of other places as well. And that acculturation is really, really helpful. So those are the hands-on things that you can do. I also want to point you to things that you can do behind the scenes, and to let you know that the Presbyterian Church USA is still really involved in refugee issues through a couple of different places. The Office of the General Assembly and Presbyterian Disaster Assistance, along with the Washington Office of the PCUSA, is doing really important work. I talked briefly with Susan Crable, who is with PDA, and is working on this particularly, and she would be very, very open to helping the congregation find ways to roll up your sleeves. So, what does PDA do? It offers information and referrals. So if you need any information, their website is filled with things, and it also creates educational resources. I didn't print them for you, but there are a lot of things that you can get online that you might use as handouts, that you might use as simply educational opportunities for yourself. If you decide to move into, on the second page, refugee ministry yourselves as a congregation, or even if you as an individual wants to do this, PDA offers technical assistance. So if you're thinking possibly as a congregation about entering into this ministry, they know the way around the block, and they can help you do that so you're not stumbling. They also know what other churches in this presbytery and in this larger area are involved in refugee work. So if you're not sure about who else is rolling up their sleeves, if you want to partner with somebody, PDA can help. They are also glad to send volunteers to help as people get started, and financial support. It's really an interesting thing that we give to the larger church in order that the church can distribute money to congregations that need that help in offering. So that's one piece. A second piece, their partnership. I want you to know that because refugee resettlement is such a politically charged issue, it's really crucial for agencies to be working together. So not surprisingly, PDA is working with the Washington offices to do that. Church World Service is an enormously helpful national resettlement outfit. And Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services as well. In particular, I want you to look under that the bullet with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. Recently, just a couple of years ago, PDA and the Lutheran Service produced a documentary I commend to you. It's called Locked in a Box, which is about what happens when illegal immigrants come into America and they are then detained and essentially stuck in limbo for a very, very long period of time. So those pieces. And then finally, just a variety of other resources that are there in refugee resettlement. I cite another film, To Breathe Free. I cite a sponsor's guide to the refugee resettlement experience. If you want to know what happened in another church, Nassau Presbyterian Church in New Jersey has done this, and they can offer their own first-person story about how to do that. There are fact sheets, and then there's political action. So the bottom of that page and into the next page gives you something from the Office of General Assembly. Some of you are more politically activist than others, and each person has their own charge from God about how activist you are. But if you are interested in doing something about refugees, this is a piece that you might borrow in order to keep in front of your senators and representatives the urgency of refugee relief. And then last but not least, a resource that comes from our own seminary. So our former dean of the faculty, Barry Jackson, did a course just last year on welcoming the stranger, the church, and migration. And if you want to have him come out and speak too, I think he'd be absolutely brilliant at it. But I stole from his syllabus the following resources with his permission. So some of us are very visual people, so films are the way to get to our hearts, and there's some really great pieces there. There are our websites. Under websites, one that you might not know about, I didn't know about, it's called Refugees Deeply, which gives regular updates about refugee situations. Then there are lots of books. I'm a fanatical reader. Bye, choir. Thank you for singing. lots of books there if you're interested. I chose from his syllabus the more recent books in particular. I did tack on at the end as well a declaration on welcoming refugees. How many of you are familiar with this declaration? Okay, a couple of you are. So one of the things that's really important in doing refugee work is to remember that we are not alone. So in 2015, Pittsburgh Presbytery decided to raise refugee issues up to the forefront. And in a very rare move, they unanimously adopted this declaration. Now, I have to tell you, I was at the last Presbytery meeting, which was my first Presbytery meeting in Pittsburgh at Pittsburgh Presbytery, and we talked about things like environmentalism and coal and steel. And it was not a unanimous vote. What I do know is that this presbytery cares about refugees in a unanimous way, which is highly unusual in a diverse political climate. Highly unusual. So, David, your point about God's constant invitation to us to do this is taken seriously by the presbytery. So I'm not going to read through it, but I just want to go down to the paragraph under the italicized Statue of Liberty. We want to remain loyal to Jesus, that sentence starts, as he was always kind and compassionate to troubled human beings. We want to be compassionate as Jesus was compassionate. Remember, he said at the end of time as we know it, he would separate people into two groups, per your citation, David. Among the blessed of God are those of whom Jesus said, I was a stranger and you welcomed me. This is why we do refugee resettlement in the end. We do it not because it's politically correct. We do it not because it makes us feel noble or virtuous. We do it not because it is somehow the right thing to do. In the end, we who call ourselves followers of Jesus do it because we want to be loyal to Jesus, because we want to welcome the stranger as Christ welcomed us, because we see in the stranger the face of Christ, because we love just as God once loved us. Thank you so much for your attention. And I and David would welcome questions and conversations. And David, come on up, if you don't mind. And what's that? I don't have all the answers. Okay. Oh, you wouldn't have hired me if you thought. But there may be things about the seminary, if you don't mind, David, to come up. He's not used to somebody telling him what to do. So sorry. Yes, question. Here, let me give you this so that others can hear as well. Please tell us.
What have you heard about?
Because you're new.
I'm brand new.
It's called South Hills Interfaith Mission Movement. Well, they have a food pantry real handy to the Prospect Park refugees where they live, Baldwin Presbyterian Church, and they have elementary school after school help with K through fifth at Whitehall Presby, and there's about 75 children there. And then is there middle school, high school?
After they have mentoring groups, et cetera. But just a point about South Hills Interfaith Movement. They are the group locally that continue to serve refugee families. So the three that you listed are excellent resources for bringing people in and supporting them in the first few months. Afterwards, other than employment, they really don't have a lot of contact. And it's up to these local groups. There's one in the North Hills that's very active. And they continue to support families. SHIM has, of its 4,000 people that it serves, about 2,000 of them are refugee families.
Wow.
So Isaac's is a big program that they get funding from the Jewish Family and Children's Center. In addition, our church has supported the initial social worker that started in the Isaac program. So these are continual programs that we locally could assist with because we don't have to then drive to Squirrel Hill
or
other locations. And as you pointed out, I really love the way that you invited us to serve. There are many different opportunities, whether you want to mentor or you could do one-off kind of thing.
Superb. Thank you for that. And forgive my ignorance. Did a little research, but not enough to know about SHIM. I'm really glad to know of it. What else? Yes.
Chris, David, it's self-evident to some of us that if you take Jesus seriously, which many of us do, that welcoming refugees and strangers is just a self-evident part of being Christian, following Christ. I'm wondering if either of you has a theory about why so many of the people in this country that are so resistant to welcoming refugees are Christians. And some of them would think of themselves as fervent Christians. Do you have any theory to account for that? Because to some of us, it seems like an extraordinary disconnect. That's why she called you up there, David.
Thank you so much, Jim. Hands up those who would like to respond. Good, got a good answer? So actually, I do have a first answer, and it's at the center of who we are as Reformed believers, and it's called original sin. It's about selfishness. So I'm afraid of losing what I think I've earned for myself. And by welcoming someone who is different, that opens me up to a whole vulnerability of maybe losing something I thought belonged to me. I'm being pretty straightforward here. I'm sort of in the center of for what it means for many of us as Americans. It's an individualism. This belongs to me. And so it's not about the Christian part of our business as Americans that we're afraid of the stranger, but I would say it's that selfish part of us. I honestly think this is part of the answer. I mean, it's a major part. And this is very, very, very difficult. Then we don't talk about it that way. We find ways to get around this, and we have reasons not to do this. But I can say more about that in a minute, but I think at the center, it's there. And the call of the gospel, the call of the welcome that we have received in Jesus, the welcome that is often we experience in congregations like this one, we enjoy that, but we need now to be led into becoming vulnerable and welcoming the stranger.
I would add just a piece as well. I suspect fear as much as selfishness personally, that for some, it's particularly around the issue of Muslim refugees. The rise of refugee resistance over these last years has been a felt fear of the other, and in particular, a fear of America losing its Christian identity, and that makes me sad because I think our Christian identity is all the stronger when we welcome the stranger. I think it enhances our individual and community identity when we embody that which Jesus asked us to do.
Some of my conservative friends, the best articulation about this subject is that they see it as a dilution, like you just mentioned, of what it had been like. And so there's the fear factor, but mostly for them, It's been the change. They're not real big agents of change. There's fear. There's the disgust in how tolerant we are, and it's sort of like they're compensating for these changes by entrenching their lives into this focus of how it used to be. And, you know, they, for whatever reason, they can't get out of that mindset. And it's disappointing. So we don't talk too much about it. Yeah.
All of us have, I suspect, some range of friends along the political continuum. And it can be dicey to talk about things. I do commend our Christian faith as a place of for those with whom we share that. I do commend that as a place of conversation, hard as it is. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
I'm curious, and I don't know if you have the answer to this or any thoughts on this, but I wonder from the refugee's perspective if, and we talk about resettlement, if they're thinking they're going to stay here or they're thinking this is a temporary thing and their home is still elsewhere and their intent is to return to their home eventually.
Sure. It depends. If they have come this far, for the most part, unless things change radically, this is now home. And a part of them has never left, especially if they still have, as most of them do, loved ones still there. It's an interesting kind of unfolding. One of my friends is from Aleppo, and her family moved here 40 years ago, so before things got really bad. She's Armenian, and they were in Aleppo because at the genocide, those who were able to make it out of the country, many of them settled in Syria, and a number of them in Aleppo. So she's watching what's happening in Syria now and is just devastated by it. But she sees her friends as never going back because it's just... It can't be rebuilt at this point. The explosion politically in Syria is so radical that it's hard for them to imagine. And that's really the key. If things look like they might normalize again, then a refugee absolutely would love to go back, but it's so rare that that's going to be the case. Yeah. One other aside about Syrian refugees. So my church in Lake Forest, Illinois, was part of a group that welcomed refugees. And we, too, were part of that second half, SHIM, the church in Clarendon Hills. We were part of the first half, the let's get them settled somewhere. But in Lake Forest, we did the, okay, now that they're here, what are we going to do? And one of the coolest things we did was... have the Syrian refugees do cooking lessons as a fundraiser. And it allowed them to express themselves and to give back in a way and to provide table hospitality to people, which they dearly, dearly wanted to do. And of course, I love that because Syrian food and Armenian food is almost exactly the same. So, but offering refugees an opportunity for self-expression, for giving, for offering, is a crucial piece of recognizing them as fully human children of God and not only those who have to receive.
One more comment on the practical side. The question you raised a minute ago illustrates how complex all of this is. It's very, very complicated. One of our responses at the seminary, is, as we were thinking about should we become involved at all, was, well, this is beyond our capability. Some of us would say something that I find quite appropriate. Well, we don't have the cultural sensitivity. We don't have the cultural training. We don't know how to do this. We don't have the political understanding, possibly. Are we helping? What are we doing about the countries at home? Part of the value, part of the value of the agencies that Chris has described that we have available here, and you know, some of you know many more of them than we do, there are folks who are looking after those kinds of questions and inviting us to, if we have housing, inviting us to read to children. We can do a little piece of this without trying to understand the whole picture, and we can be involved in God's hospitality on a small piece. This, on the practical side, this became very important for me as I was thinking about the work of the seminary. We didn't have to master all of these complex, very complex issues, but we could play a small part.
One other piece about the seminary that I think Dr. Esther Line is a little bit modest about is our... enormous resource in world mission. So David himself was a mission worker along with Jane in Fiji and Cameroon, right? And knows cross-cultural better than any other seminary president I know by a very, very long stretch. And then Hunter Farrell, who heads our World Mission Institute, had been the head of denominational world mission for the whole of the PCUSA. Hunter knows from cross-cultural better than anyone except maybe David. those resources, you know, if you are interested in how to be cross-cultural, how to be welcoming across nationalities and even religious differences, please think of the seminary as a resource that can be of help to you, because that's what we're here to do.
Yes, I was going to ask about that too. One of the people in the room today used to be chair of the World Mission Initiative. Hunter and I had a conversation a couple weeks ago. I've been on a couple of their trips. It's an extraordinary resource. Two things, I guess. One, do you find that the World Mission Initiative, one purpose of which is to make sure that seminary students at PTS have cross-cultural experiences, do you find that that sort of cross-fertilizes awareness of responsiveness to people from other cultures, including refugees? And then related to that, do you think that that makes Pittsburgh Seminary a rather uniquely rich base from which cultivating support for people and understanding across cultures might influence not only ministers who go out to serve churches in the area, but perhaps the larger culture?
That's my hope. I have to say, coming in new, and David has a larger vision, and we'll hand him the microphone in a second, but as a new person, I am stunned by the sophistication and thoroughness with which our students are trained in cross-cultural global initiatives, because we're in a global time, and we can't go backwards as much as we'd like to, some of us, in time. So how do we participate in the world that God so loves by knowing who the other is? And it's a remarkable gift to our students, and I hope to the community as well.
So thank you so much for the question, Jim. I thought I could just say, yes, of course, Pittsburgh Seminary is the best. So thanks. In fact, many seminaries, certainly many of the PCUSA seminaries and many others, are working very, very hard at exactly what you're talking about. There are seminaries that are ahead of ours. We're alongside. And it's a very, very complex business. How can we live faithfully with integrity with the world that God loves so much? It's an enormous kind of question and task. Being able to visit, being able to see oneself and one's location through the eyes of another place, it changes our lives. It certainly, my understanding of race and racism and white privilege in this country began when I lived in different parts of the world, and I began to see, oh, I hadn't really looked at my own place. So I'm convicted and convinced about that as appropriate. But then also the engagement with denominations and churches in other parts of the world, seminaries and theological institutions in other parts of the world, where we can live in partnership that has a depth of trust and integrity, becomes very important, hopefully as a model for those who then walk into congregations like this one to develop the same kinds of partnerships. So there are many aspects to this. But I will say, thankfully, there are many seminaries are working very, very hard at this to understand how to be engaged in the world that God loves, which we can describe in so many ways. But coming back to that basic one, I think, is very important.
One last word. I know we're coming close to ending, but for me, in my interaction with other global Christians, I've even global people of other faith, I've discovered how much more it blesses me than the extent to which I give. We think about doing mission, including refugee mission, as a way for us to extend the hospitality of Christ. And it is that. But what I think we forget sometimes is that as we do that, we too are transformed. That we are blessed by the stranger. That we discover in ourselves things we hadn't known, assumptions that we make about our own understanding of what Christianity looks like, our own assumptions about what it means to be a person of faith. And we are blessed by an intimacy of being with people who have gone through so much, and we recognize how much we are one human family. It's not just about giving to others. It is also about the way that God transforms us as we seek to come into relationship with those in this particular need, and I've been richly blessed by it. Thank you.